There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Dr. Thuraya Kanafani, clinical psychologist based at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. Now, she's on hand to take your questions on any areas you might be struggling with today, whether it be depression or maybe addiction, whether it's you, a family member, a colleague at work. She can help people with mood disorders and anxiety. Now, Thuraya specializes in working with people of all ages, but particularly teenagers as well, with mental health disorders. Hello and welcome back to the show, Dr. Thuraya.
Good morning, Suzanne.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you. Change. Are you somebody that adapts well and adjusts well to change?
I think as the years have passed by, I have tried to become more resilient to change. I mean, I think most of us have a fear of change because it's sort of the fear of the unknown. And, you know, we're very comfortable in our comfort zones. And sometimes it's a little bit difficult for us to make changes in our life. But I think the more you expose yourself and you challenge yourself, the more comfortable you become with making changes in your life.
Now, if you've had a nice, long, lazy, carefree summer, getting back into that routine can be a struggle. Or for some, they might be absolutely welcoming it. It's time to get back to it, get back into our houses and homes, get back into Dubai life and get the children back into school.
I've actually heard a lot of mothers say that they're actually happy that school's starting because then they can get back into the routine. And, you know, it can be quite overloading for a lot of people over the summer vacation where they have all of their kids around and then all the kids are done. And so everybody's just surrounded by children. And then when you're not used to having that on a day-to-day basis, breaking that routine can be quite stressful. And so going back to school can actually be a good change for a lot of people. But for some people, it can actually be a little bit sad because, you know, especially during the summer vacation, it's time to reunite with family, sort of go to new places, see people you haven't seen in a long time. And so that can leave you quite nostalgic when you leave. And so it sets this sort of sad feeling when you go away. And especially in a city like Dubai, there's a lot of diversity here, but not many families, extended families live here. And so people can feel quite alone. So when they come back, they feel, okay, now I'm back into that routine. I have to get myself back on track.
So if we just stop and sort of pause on that a moment, yeah, it could be that people have been away for a considerable amount of time. Not only are they back in home country or back with extended family, but they may have got into a different kind of routine. All of the sights, smells, the familiarities that you've kind of thought you've forgotten about come back to the fore as you start to live that life, because some people have been away for over a month, you know, and so you really are getting into another culture, even if it's your culture of origin.
Absolutely, because really when you're working every day and you're sort of in the mix of being busy, being sort of part of, you know, the life that you have, your day-to-day routine here, what ends up happening is when you travel, you start to become more mindful, more conscious of the things that are around you, because you start to calm down a bit, things start to slow down a bit in your life. And you, like you said, Suzanne, even if you go back to the same country you're from, you tend to see things differently, notice things differently, because obviously in the year that you've been away, you've also grown as a person. So that in and of itself is change when you go back and you start to see things and observe things and experience things in a different way.
As human beings, we have change. I mean, change is happening all the time, but obviously the big things that make us feel differently. I mean, from a psychological point of view, how is the human psyche equipped to deal with change?
Well, usually we are creatures of habit in general. Obviously, there are some people that crave change and need change constantly in their lives. But in general, people are a creature of habit because of the fact of the variables that we know, and it's safer. And evolutionarily, what we do is we like what's safe because it guarantees our succession in life and our you know, reproductive genetic pass down. And so when it comes to being in our comfort zone, most people prefer to do that and try to stay away from too much change, especially too much change that may cause a ripple effect and create different changes in their lives as well. So more often than not, as human beings, we're not big fans of big changes in our life, but we will look at different aspects of our life as a possibility to change if we are able to really understand the variables and sort of make a more logical sort of plan for it, because we like to feel like we are in control. And even though this is greatly an illusion that we have that we are in control of the things that are around us, what ends up happening is that the more we can sort of track and plan, the more likely we are to make certain changes.
I suppose there's not many places in the world where you might leave your home, as in here, to go and recamp somewhere else for at least a month, even up to 2 months in some cases. And that might not be just through the summer. It might happen again at Christmas or, you know, even two or three times through the year. So it's a kind of different way of living in to a great extent. How that impacts you or how that impacts the children. And there's always that sort of thought, isn't there, as an expatriate, that you end up with one foot in one camp and one in another. You never really settle in one place. So we're going to be exploring change throughout the show in all its different forms when it comes to relationships. I mentioned earlier, we're going to be taking a look at an article from the UK's Telegraph, post-summer reboot, how to make changes at home, at work and in your relationships this September. Now, Anna Hart, who is a healer and an author and a coach, she talks about the fact that in the UK, September is when you see a spike in the rates of divorce because people have relaxed through the summer, had that break, and somehow they've reevaluated their lives in some way. That might be the case. We're going to be taking a look at that, how to heal, how to fix, and also sustain positive relationships throughout the years. And, you know, for many people in the UAE, they might have been away from their partner through the summer, and the children have been away from their partners. So how's that faring? And, of course, school is back. It's back to school this week and the coming weeks for schools all starting at different dates over the next couple of weeks. So how are the kids faring with that? Susan's texting about her son who's off to university in a few weeks. Susan, I'm glad you've texted in because we've got on our list of to-do today on the show is talking about the empty nest syndrome. It's something many people are facing as their children leave the UAE to go off to universities across the globe. So again, how to manage that, as Susan says, how to cope with him leaving on a positive note. We'll help you with that and more in just a few moments. We're talking about change. Are you going through a change at the moment, whether it's coming back after the summer, whether it's starting a new job or the children going back to school, whatever that change may be, how's it going for you? When it comes to the teenagers who might be flying the coop, flying the nest, if you will, as they head off to university, you've looked after them for 18 years through the good times and the bad. You've been a teacher, mentor, confidant, taxi service, chief cook and bottle washer, and now they've gone. There's a strange stillness around the home as you take down the to-do list. And now for Susan, who's messaged the show, this is what she's facing with her son. He's off to university in a few weeks. He was born here and he's excited to go and study in the UK, but Susan will miss him terribly. So how does she cope with him leaving and manage it on a positive note, in a positive way?
Well, you know, Suzanne, like you mentioned before, the emptiness syndrome is when parents feel a sense of loss and a sense of sadness that their children are leaving or, like you said, flying the nest. But there's also an embedded fear in their safety and also in their ability to actually live on their own. So one of the things that I try to get parents to do for themselves to help themselves sort of work through this is to teach kids some chores, some things that they can do to live on their own. So obviously, you know, washing their clothes, separating the colors from the whites, cooking simple things, quick things. And if you don't have like a kitchen, how to make sandwiches and things like that. And just really giving them proper life skills to help them so that you can feel more confident in their ability to live alone and be independent. And that will set your mind at ease as well. Obviously, all teenagers, you want to educate them about the dangers that are out there in the world. You help them understand where to go, what to do, what not to do, what to stay away from. So that helps with the safety of the fears that most parents have. When it comes to the sadness that they're leaving, you know, always looking at the positive side that they are growing and that they're going to be, they're not very far. And at the same time, thankfully, because of technology we have all over the world, we can Skype them, FaceTime them, you know, do all of these things really quickly. So set schedules on when to do that so that you're able to actually communicate with them and you know that you can communicate with them at certain times during the week.
In fact, you could communicate with them all the time, pretty right. much, couldn't you? I'm sure they might not want you to do that, but you could. It's a very different age to what it used to be like when kids left home as expatriates. You know, it was very difficult to connect and communicate and keep that communication going. So it's fantastic with technology that's happening, that's there. Also with universities, the semesters are relatively short, the holidays are relatively long. So again, I suppose it's about setting yourself mental, you know, that I know I'm going to see them again in 6 weeks time, or mm-hmm. That kind of thing. There's an element, I suppose, as well, letting the children, letting these, you know, young adults go, because if they are being pulled back emotionally and psychologically back to family and home country, meaning here where they've left the UAE, it might be harder for them to settle where they are now and to get them through. We hear a lot about expatriate kids not settling at university and struggling in that first year, possibly if they leave at the age of 18. So they're things to consider. Now, looking at this article from The Guardian that you brought to the table, Thuraya, listening here from lecturer Patrick Mulrennan, he says it can be hard at first, but you get used to it. From different parts of London, our twin sons left at the same time, one to Sussex and the other to Sheffield. It was terrible. I thought my life was over and I would never recover, he says. One minute you are a parent, the next minute you're back to an empty house with all their stuff gone. I miss them dreadfully, and I miss their friends coming round too. He goes on to say that him and his wife went out more for a while, but then things settled back. After about 3 weeks, I realised I felt better. I thought, actually, this isn't too bad. It's strange that once they're away at university, you stop worrying about them so much. While they were at home, I would be worrying all the time. And, you know, where are they? What are they up to? But now I don't so much. I just trust them to be sensible. So again, that sort of, you've got to work towards letting them go for them to have their independence, but also to release yourself, really, from that anxiety.
Absolutely. And, you know, a big part of that also comes into when you're holding on so tight to your kids, you're actually harming them more than helping them, because essentially they need to learn how to be adults. And if they don't know how to do that without the backing of their parents, then they'll always feel like they have, you know, something to fall back on. This is not to say that parents shouldn't be supportive, shouldn't be there for their children, but there also has to be a proper balance between giving them their independence as well as still holding on. Because essentially for a child, it's very scary to move to university. I mean, it's a different city, it's a different environment, it's a different study style.
Country,
absolutely. It's, you know, different. Even academically, it's very different, because, you know, when you're in high school, everybody sort of knows everybody. You're not a number. But when you go to university, you're almost like a number to everybody there. And then there's also sociocultural changes that happen. Even if you're going back to a country that you're from, it's still very different, because you've lived, especially for Susan, her son's been born here and he lived here his whole life. So even if he's from the UK, when he goes back, he will be very different from the students and the children that are there, because he grew up differently. He grew up in a much more multicultural environment. Most people here are expats. People come and go. They're very resilient, you know. So many of those changes are already difficult. And of course, they're going to miss their parents. They're going to miss mom's cooking. They're going to miss the laundry being done for them, the bed being made. So there are so many things that the child is going through anyways. We have to be careful not to add to that by putting on our sadness and our, you know, fear onto them as well.
Well, Eleanor talks in this article, she writes about the fact that she was fine with her daughter going to university, but she had to admit that after a few weeks, she realised that the dynamics within the house, the dynamics of the family had changed. So you might have other children, you know, but one's gone, the rest are here, or it might be an only child, whatever it is, the energy of the house is going to change in some way. So what do you do as a parent? What do you do to make positive changes, to adapt and adjust to this?
Sometimes I tell parents to look at it as this is like you reborn, right? I mean, because you've been a parent for such a long time, and when you're a parent first before anything else. And so at this point, it's about you getting to know yourself. Who are you now? Because your child's been with you for 18 years, which means at this point, you've been 18 years focused more on your child than on yourself. So now it's about rediscovering yourself, rediscovering your marriage, rediscovering your relationship with your other children. It's about looking at your life and reflecting and sort of evaluating and seeing what it is that you want to do. So take it as sort of like it's a new chapter for you rather than an end to another chapter.
So find things to do, find things to enjoy, take it as an opportunity. Don't sit waiting or monitoring or following where your child is. Maybe the first week or so, but you know, ultimately you've got to fill your life and your house with that energy. You know, and I think what this particular guy, Robert Triffitt, says. And don't get too used to it. They'll be back in the holidays. It's only a few weeks away. And in 3 years after they've finished university, they might be boomeranging back and you've got them back living with you. Whether that's good or not, whatever the circumstances are. And of course, you can arrange to meet and see them. You know, there's opportunities where you might be able to go and visit, or maybe you meet halfway. So it's about putting some things in place to look forward to where you're going to see them and spend some time with them again. But in the meantime, make sure you've got the opportunity now. Maybe you've got a bit more time to actually do something for yourself.
Of course.
Susan, we hope that helps. We're talking about change today on The Couch with Dr. Thariah Kanafani, clinical psychologist from the Human Relations Institute and Clinics based in JLT. So what do you make of change? Do you adapt well? Do you resist it? Do you struggle with it? And maybe you're going through some kind of change in your life at the moment. If you are, let us know. Let's see if we can help. Otherwise, just to share the story is always interesting to us, because we realise as more and more people contribute to the show, how much we are connected in some way, or we can relate to each other in some way. It does help. Another quote here is, one reason people resist change is because they focus on what they have to give, or what they have to give up, instead of what they have to gain. Would you agree with that, Dr. Thariah?
Absolutely. And this goes back to being in your comfort zone, right? Because you're so focused on what you have currently, and that's scary to let it go, because you're not really sure of what you might actually gain moving forward.
Well, the kids are back to school time. How's that going for you? Are you adjusting, and how are the kids doing? There might be some first day jitters, depending what age there are, or you know, even whether it's going to school first day ever, or whether it's having had that summer break and maybe moving up a school or going into a new class. So how do you get the children back into the routine of time to bed, time to get up, getting breakfast changed, all of that, getting your schoolwork together and preparing for a new term? Now, lots of children can feel anxious at this time, as well as the parents as well, depending what the circumstances are. So what can we do to help people that might be going through this, Dr. Thariah?
Well, you know, actually, the Gulf News talks about that there are over a million children that are going to be starting school in September this year. So that is quite a lot of children. And that shift between not just summer back to the same school, because even if the child is going to their same school, this is still a transition for them, because they could be moving from eighth grade to ninth grade. So from middle school to high school, from primary school to middle school. So these transitional changes can bring about a lot of social, emotional, and psychological fears as well. But at the same time, they can be very exciting. So it's a little bit of like a double-edged sword. So kids are really excited to go back and see their friends or meet new people. But at the same time, they're very scared because, you know, they have to be exposed either to a new school or to a new area, new teachers, new classrooms, new subjects. So there's so many things that are sort of that can bring out a lot of anxiety in children. And it's important for parents to sort of prepare them for that. So especially in the younger years, usually a lot of schools have what they call a transition period, which means parents go with them to school. They show them the classes that they're going to go to. They take them around. They're sort of with them there, so the child develops a sense of safety and security at the school. Sometimes the parents will be there at the school for the first week and not necessarily, and the children won't necessarily see them, just in case they need them, that they're there. So those are in the younger years. But in the older years, like middle school, high school, sometimes it's good to take them a little bit early, show them where their locker is going to be, show them where their classes are going to be. Sometimes it's even good to role play some things at home. So what would you do if this happened, or what would you do if that happened? So really try to get them to think of different ways to help themselves alleviate their anxiety when they go to school.
Now, this is an interesting point that's come in about I talked to my son about starting school. He's 8, going back to school, but he says he's fine. He's excited. He's not, you know, doesn't really engage that much with me, but he seems okay in what he's saying. But his body language to me isn't saying he's okay. And that's interesting, because that's in this article as well, about, you know, talking to your child, listening to what they're saying, but also watching and looking at how they are in their body language.
in that kind of time, obviously with younger children, they want to seem like they're strong and they're fearless and they're very courageous and they can face anything. So it's important to sort of what we like to call at the office, it's listening to the unspoken word. So what you would do is really just sort of, they're saying, yeah, I'm fine, everything's great, but you're noticing that they're not, and sort of say, wow, you know, you're so strong. If I was in your position, I don't know if I would be worried about this and I would be worried about that. So how could you help me? Like, what would I have to do? So almost like put it on yourself rather than on the child, and then have the child talk through it. And through that, you're actually alleviating and reducing their own anxieties. And those are for the younger kids, obviously. And an 8-year-old, you can do that. You can't do that with the teenagers. They'll probably laugh at you if you talk to them that way. But it's still the sort of same idea. You know, when you're talking to any teenager, you can tell them, look, it's going to be difficult. You're going to meet new people. You're going to meet some really horrible people. You're going to meet some awesome people. What are you looking for in a friend? What are you looking for in a teacher? Like, if you have a question, what would you do? So it's about giving them the different scenarios and alleviating their anxiety by discussing what they could be anxious about.
Now, I always have to put a caveat in here with these kind of discussions, is that we don't want to put our anxiety onto the child. We don't want to make a problem if a problem isn't there. So it's about getting the balance, isn't it? So, you know, this is what we have to do. We have to go to school. We have to have a routine. We have to get back into it. So there's, you know, a structure, and you've got to be committed to that structure, and there's a sort of discipline involved in you as a family committing to that structure and routine of the day. But it's about just being aware how you're, particularly depending on what the personality of your child is and what the history's been in school or what they're telling you, or like you say, in some cases it's about what's not being said, just knowing your child, I suppose. It's looking here at this article saying as well that, you know, if you are concerned or your child's showing some anxiety or there are worries there, then seek support from an older sibling who might be at the same school or a trusted friend. So buddy them up with a child maybe in class or in the school. So there's just someone looking out, or they know that, you know, in break time you can go and find your older brother or sister, or just to check in that they're doing okay. If you think there's concerns there, right? Not necessarily to do it just for the sake of doing it.
Absolutely. You don't want to overwhelm the child when they're back at school. But if you do see, like you were saying, you know, listening and understanding, being aware of your child. So if your child tends to adjust well, is very resilient when they go into a new school, new environment, then there's no need to go through all of this. But just check in with them every once in a while, make sure they're okay. But if you know that your child is very introverted, is very shy, it tends to get anxious very quickly, then these are the steps that would definitely help them moving forward.
Know where the toilets are.
Right.
That's always
that's
deal.
A big one.
It's
yes.
A big deal for children, isn't it? Little children, that anxiety that goes with not sure and the rest of it. And, you know, and when they get home from school in the first week, the kind of conversations you can have at the dinner table when you're having, you know, whether it's a snack when you get in or sitting around together as a family, hopefully that's what you're able to do, or even in the car on the way home. So turning this change, this transition phase, into a positive experience.
Of course, and definitely the first week is by far so important that they feel that they can come home to a supportive environment. So if you get to sit down, put all your phones aside, have that conversation, how was school today? But not in the how was school today, just tell me it's good so we can move on to the next topic. More like really ask, how was school? How are your teachers? Who are your teachers? You know, did you meet anybody in class? Was anybody mean or not? You know, so of course you don't want to bombard them with questions, but throughout the week, just to sort of test the water, see where they're at, in order to gauge if they're in a good place or not.
They're certainly going to be tired if they've been off for, what has it been, like 11 weeks or something?
It's
it really that long?
Quite a while.
It's been a long time. So getting back into routine and getting into school and lessons and all that goes with it, and extracurricular activities, they're going to be tired come first weekend, second week, and even the first month, as they make that adjustment, allowing for the weekends maybe as well for them to get some sleep, to catch up.
Absolutely. And we also have another break coming up, a long weekend. So that's going to interrupt the routine as well. So I think it's getting back into the routine by far is the most important thing. Structure, creating a structure at home for everybody to follow so that the kids are able to get used to it and recognize that they might not always be in a good mood the first couple of weeks, and be a little bit more lenient with that.
So what about going back to work? For the grown-ups who have been off and maybe had a month off and getting back in after the Eid break, I mean, it depends, I suppose, how long you've been off to what your adjustment's like, but maybe you're going to start a new job. But, you know, it's talked about in the Telegraph article, post-summer reboot and making changes at home, at work and in your relationships. So first up on the holiday side, they talk about, and they've spoken to different experts and coaches, so how not to leave your holiday on holiday, and also how to maybe bring your holiday with you. So some of the things that you've learned over the holiday break, and maybe it's a change of wardrobe, maybe it's you've been reading certain books and looking at what you want to do with your future, bring that with you. You know, if you've discovered a new activity or something you particularly like, bring that back into Dubai with you into your over the next few months, so you can carry a bit of your holiday forward.
You know, during the year when we're actually going through our busy schedules, we're not very mindful and reflective on the things that we're doing and ourselves and our lives. So when we go on holiday, what happens is we call it the holiday blues when you're back, because obviously, you know, you've had such a great time and then you come back, and bringing some of that back with you is so important. Learning, taking from what you've learned over the summer or over the winter break, and then bringing that back and integrating it into your life is important. Obviously, you can't integrate everything, because, you know, your routine and your busy life is different here. But you can find the small things that you can bring back. Like you said, change of wardrobe. It could be maybe an activity that you found interesting over the summer. You can now apply into your life, not daily routine, but maybe over like a month, 2 months, create it as a hobby. Pictures, very important. Sometimes, you know, we take so many pictures from our phone and then we leave them on our phone and we don't really look back on them. Sometimes it's good to print them so you can see them when you walk in, those kind of things. So it's about reliving the experience without actually having to go back and take another holiday.
So having positive plans prepared before the stress of normal life starts to kick in keeps you on track. So prevention is easier than a cure. So all that you've sort of garnered over the break, rest, relaxation, positive mindset, try and keep that going over the next few months. Don't let it go. If you can, keep that balance. So your thoughts, Kabir's texting. We're going to share his thoughts in a moment, and the rest of you, 4001 or via the Messenger app. Your thoughts on change, whether you're good at change, not so good. What are you facing at the moment? Are you transitioning or going through some kind of change? MS messaged in earlier about talking about change. I want to take on a new degree. He's looking for a positive psychology university course in Dubai. So we'll come back on that. And yeah, keep your messages coming in. How are you with change? Do you embrace it? Are you resisting it? What changes are you going through at the moment? Kabir's text in saying resistance to change resides in the unconscious part of the mind. As human beings, even on a cellular level, we're always changing. It's my experience that being in the present moment allows us to recognize our potential to be spontaneous and welcome change. It is such a beautiful experience to be open to change and an essential attribute of the creative potential of being human. That's according to Kabir. What do you think? What do you think, Thraya?
Well, I think resistance to change can be very, I mean, it's very innate in all of us. Like I had mentioned before, you know, evolutionarily, we like to stay in our comfort zone because it helps us understand that we're safe here. But when it comes to our resistance to change, there are so many different reasons why. One of them is the uncertainty. We don't like to be uncertain of what's coming. We don't like to not know what the variables are in the next step in our life. And that can be very scary for many people. So the first thing that we do is say to ourselves, okay, I'm good here. I know this. I feel in control of this. So I'm just going to stay here because this is safer for me. And this is a very subconscious thought process. Obviously, we're not saying this to ourselves on a daily basis, but that feeling of control is what keeps us in our comfort zone. It keeps us feeling like we can take care of this because we know this. So that resistance to change comes a big part from the uncertainty, from the feeling of the loss of control, as well as from our resistance to be in something that we're not sure of.
But, you know, sometimes we need to be like that. It's a good thing to stay where you are in whatever that means, if it's serving you and if you feel... I suppose what the question is I don't think you have to change every time you have to work out what is important to you. And if you've figured out something that's important to you and then you have the fear of change, that's what you, when you have to address it, right?
Right.
I mean, I totally agree. It's, I mean, sometimes when you start unpacking that idea of fear, it's because of that sense of wanting to be in control and needing to have that structure or whatever it is that is changing in your life. But sometimes things change and it's not, you don't even know where it's coming. You know, the person that turns around and rejects you and says it's over, I want to leave, the marriage is done and you didn't see it coming, or, you know, heaven forbid there's some terrible accident and that changes your life forever. Sometimes life just throws that curveball at you and change happens completely. You didn't know it was coming, you didn't invite it, you didn't see it, and then you've got to deal with it. And some people may have more resilience than others. It depends what's going on in your life at the time. It depends where it leaves you afterwards, I suppose.
Of course. You know, if you're in a comfort zone and you're happy there and things are going well for you, there's no need to change in that moment. But if you're unhappy, if there's something that's not working for you and you recognize that and you're still resisting that change, that is where the problem is. And like you said, Suzanne, life is chaotic and it's very unpredictable. So we feel that we do have control, but it is our perception. It is purely our illusion of control. And so that's why we hold on to the things that we feel like we are controlling, because we're so scared of the chaos that life will provide to us. And a big part of that also comes from our inability to trust in ourselves, that we have the competence and the capability to get through whatever it is we need to do to get to that change.
I do think it's interesting what Kabir is saying about living in the present moment. And for people that feel they need to be in control, that could be quite a scary thing, because the idea is that you're trusting, you're not making things happen or trying to predict or trying to plan, make so many plans so you've covered all the bases just in case. And I know when I've practiced meditation with certain teachers, you know, it's all about being present. But one of the things they teach you with meditation, so whether it, you know, be breathing exercises and going into deep meditation, is that it's supposed to equip you so that when that curveball happens, as in your physical being and in your psychological state, you're able to respond apparently in a more resilient way if you have that practice of meditation. Now, I'm not saying that's right or wrong. That's just what I have been told when I've been practicing meditation. And please feel free to let me know what you think about that. But at the end of the day, as human beings, we're all trying to prepare ourselves to be resilient and strong and happy and balanced. And so it's finding those skills that work for us. Others might say it's doing sport or a lot of physical activity. It makes me robust mentally and physically. So when something happens untoward, I'm not expecting, I'm able to cope. You know, there's many different things, but that's the beauty of psychology, isn't it?
And I think you hit the nail on the head, Suzanne, when you're talking about not just meditation, but even sports or other things. All of those share one thing in common, and that's being mindful. And when you are mindful, you're present. And when you're mindful of what's happening with you, you feel less in a chaotic environment. Because when you, like you said, when life throws you a curveball, everything feels so chaotic. But when you are mindful and present about what's happening to you, you feel more in control. And that helps you become more resilient and to look at your environment and your situation in a much clearer way, so that you can get through whatever it is that you need to get through in that moment.
Well, one of our listeners has texted in to say, like ill health, when you're not expecting those results, and that can change your life forever. So yeah, again, you know, circumstances like your health or getting sick and how you deal with what's being brought to you and the changes you might have to make in your life. Here's another quote for you, and it really is aligned with what you're saying, Kabir. At some point, you just have to let go of what you thought should happen and live in what is actually happening. So yeah, we're talking about change today. Are you going through some kind of change in your life? Is something happening around you? You might be new to the UAE. If you are, hello and welcome. Thanks for joining us. And yeah, you know, it's an exciting time ahead for you living in this this city, coming with fresh eyes, learning and navigating your way around the UAE, and not only through the roads, but, you know, the systems, the culture. And, you know, I'm sure coming with lots of great anticipation. And for so many people, those expectations will be fulfilled. However, you have come from somewhere else. So as we were talking at the top of the show about, you know, if you are leaving, or, you know, or if you've been in the summer months back in the in your home country, what about for those people arriving to the UAE as expatriates, what they will be going through as they start to settle here over the coming months? So if you've got any tips or advice on how to settle into the UAE as a newbie, let me know on those numbers, and we'll address all of the issues and all of your thoughts in just a few minutes. Stay with us.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
So, Dr. Thuraya, the environment we're in the UAE is all about change and changing up. And then as people arrive to start their lives here, what might they be going through? What might they need to consider?
Well, there's a lot of different emotions. You know, obviously excitement is one of them, because Dubai is a very vibrant city, and it's known all across the world to be a very interesting city as well. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the picture 30 years back of the, you know, the Sheikh Zayed Road, and now when you look at it, it's something completely different. And so, like you said, change is all about Dubai. So when people come here, they can feel very overwhelmed as well as overstimulated, because they're looking around. There's just so much to do here. There's so much to see. There's a sense of obviously missing their home country, so being homesick a bit, missing family, feeling sort of disconnected from their hometowns. But there is that excitement that, you know, something is new, something is exciting here. You know, it's a new job, new opportunity. Now, for a lot of people, when they come here, the misconception, as you can say, is that people come here for the money. But that's not necessarily true. There are a lot of people that come here because there's a lot better healthcare here than in other countries. There's better schooling here than in other countries. You know, financial progression, you know, different opportunities for jobs. So, you know, obviously Dubai is a very growing city economically, and the market is growing. But at the same time, you know, there are people that come here from all over the world. Sometimes they feel that maybe the healthcare plan here is not as great as their home country, but for other countries, this is a haven for them. And also in terms of security, in terms of safety, I mean, we live in Dubai, it's such a safe city, and this is safe for a lot of people that come to visit here. So sometimes this could be a sense of relief for them, or there are a lot of people that work here that send money home, and so this is a sort of a financial area for them. So they make the money, they can send back to their family, and they can provide them with a life that they would have never been able to provide them had they lived and worked in their own home country. So Dubai provides a lot of things for expats, but that could also lead to a lot of confusion, because you like it, the city, and you work so hard here. But at the same time, the work-life balance can be quite overwhelming at times.
But also, you know, before you get to that, you know, you've made a decision to come here, and you may have had months in the planning, or maybe not very much time in the planning. And so, yeah, you're coming because you've made a decision, so one assumes that you're happy and excited. But sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes if there's a couple, you've got like what you call the trailing spouse, who, you know, it might be that one half of the couple is really happy about being here, but the other one isn't, whether it's the husband or the wife, whichever way it might be, or the children don't settle, but the parents think this is a good move. So there's a lot of different things to consider, isn't there? And also, I think it's really interesting that it's not always about the money. That's true. It's a lifestyle, maybe, and like you said, you know, the healthcare or whatever it is, it's different to your home country. But I guess naturally, as a human being, even though you've made the decision, when you arrive, you can't help but compare. You can't help but always be thinking, well, that how is that compared to where I've just come from? Mm-hmm. And that's natural, and maybe that's a good thing, but sometimes that's not a good thing.
Right, of course, because, you know, when you look back, there's always, when, you know, you're homesick, you always say to yourself, you know, things are better there, and, you know, this is better there, and that is better there. But ultimately, when you're able to take a step back, once you've moved here and settled here, you're able to see things for what they are. And every country and every city has its positives and its negatives. But like you said, Suzanne, you know, it's not everybody that moves here is not wanting to move here. Some people have to move here either for financial reasons, or some people are, like you said, the trailing spouse and the kids. Most, I mean, there are a lot of kids that come here and they were so happy in their city and their father found a new job here or their mother found a new job here, and so they had to uproot, leave everything that they know, their aunts, their uncles, their grandparents, and then come here. So like you said, there are a lot of people that don't necessarily want to make this shift, and that could be very difficult for them to transition. But at the same time, there are people that do look at the positives. And for those that don't want to move here, they tend to hold on to that and become resentful, and then they become angry, and then they tend to just reject the city altogether. Whereas those that are willing to give it a shot are able to open up and see the positives in the city that they move to.
And I think that's the key, isn't it? You've got to be open, surely. You can't just arrive here and recreate your own little place of where you've just come from. You have to look around you and adapt and adjust to where you are. So explore the city. I mean, I know people that have been here many years that have, like, even never been to Deira, have never even gone down to the creek, which I find extraordinary. But, you know, some people, like you said earlier, creatures of habit and recreate their own little culture within the culture. And on that note, we have to talk about the culture and that being aware of it's different. It's going to be different from where you've come from. Even if you share the same faith, it's still going to be different because the environment is different.
Absolutely. And also it's what I think you use a perfect word is different. It's not good, it's not bad, it's different. So there's no judgment to it. And so when you look at a culture and you may not necessarily agree with what they're doing, it doesn't mean that what they're doing is wrong because you're not used to it. It's just something that's different. And you don't necessarily have to participate, but you have to respect. And I think that's what some people find difficulty, is that they're so used to thinking that, you know, where they were was perfect. So when they look at things that are different, they tend to look down upon it rather than, and that's not just for the culture of the host country, but it's also the culture of the people who are in the host country as well.
That's interesting, isn't it? So if we're using the word change, but if we take the word different, as human beings, this need for people to be like you, this need for, it's almost that tribal instinct, you know, we are better, you need to be like us. And some people are like that, others aren't. But it is interesting, isn't it, how you can see that happening. Some people are like, I feel comfortable, in control, all those words we've used throughout the show about change, with the idea of people being the same as me. I want that. I don't want to change, or I don't want something that's different, or people that are different around me.
And you know, it's interesting, that's not just moving into a city like Dubai for work, but that's also when you go to university. I mean, I remember when I was in university, the first thing I wanted to do is meet new people, people I've never met and were not from my culture, were not from my religion, nothing. They were just different than me. And I had friends that stuck to the same culture, religion, country, language, and it was shocking to me to see that all they wanted to do was recreate their life in their previous country in the new country, and that's all they took back. So they didn't really experience the beauty of the country that they were in. And that's what I think is really important when you move to a new place. It's about opening yourself up and being open to try to experience the beauty of the culture that you're in currently.
Your thoughts on that, arriving in the UAE, for people arriving over the summer that arrived here for the first time to put their roots down to live here? What advice would you give them? How have you embraced it? Because there's no getting away from it. It's going to be a change wherever you've come from. Settling here like you would settling anywhere, it's going to be different. So how do you embrace it? How do you make it work and make that transition? And I suppose it's like anything, there's a process to this. It doesn't happen overnight. You've got to allow to work through the process, but you have to make an effort with that. And that word being open, I guess, is all important. A couple of you, and we mentioned earlier, we must come back to this, have talked about health issues. So one here about this person's mother who's just been diagnosed with cancer, breast cancer. Now, what's interesting in this question, thank you very much for the message, is that this is about the mother being back in home country. So kind of everything we've been talking about, in that, you know, you might have spent some time at home with family. Now you're back in your life in Dubai. How do you feel about that? And then when you get something like a family crisis or a diagnosis like this, there's a lot of guilt that goes with the family or the family member that's not there with that person or back in home country.
Right. Guilt is definitely one of the first things that comes up, that I have to be there. You know, I need to be there. I need to help. But also there's that fear. What if I'm not there if something bad happens? So there's those two major dominant emotions that start to come out. And a big part of that has to do with the fact that, you know, they feel responsible, almost like the sickness. It's very subconscious, but it's very much like, you know, if I had been there, I could have helped more, or I could have taken care of them, or I could have, you know, taken to her hospital sooner, you know, those kind of things. But it's recognizing that you are not in control of that situation. And like you said before, that is a curveball that's just being thrown at you, and it's a very unfortunate situation. But in that moment, there's nothing that you can do except be supportive and be there for your family member, in this case, your mother. Even long distance is the same. It doesn't mean you have to be there physically in order to really give that support and that love and show that care. You can do that from far as well.
And that's okay. Different family members might have comment about it or not, but I guess it's about allowing yourself. I think as an expatriate, there's always an element of guilt, because wherever you are, you're not, there's always that thing, I should be there. You can't be in two places at once, but you can be there emotionally, verbally, you know, there in spirit. You can be there for that person without being in the room with them. You've just got to show it and communicate it.
Of course. And another part of that is also the guilt from, you know, not being there because I can do more. And then okay, if you go back and you're there and now you've moved away from wherever you are, and then you go back and you're helping out, and then your mother gets better or your family member gets better, and then you've lost your job, you've lost everything. How much guilt are they going to feel once they're better because of what's happened with you as well? So instead of adding more guilt and more, you know, frustration to the situation, more stress to the situation, recognizing that this is my limit. I'm going to be there in the best way that I can, but I won't necessarily have to be there physically, because this is also important, that I also have to do this on this side.
I'm sure in many cases, the family member wants you to be all right. You don't want to, your career or your situation to be compromised too much. So it's about prioritizing, isn't it? And knowing when it's going to be really important or really make a difference that you're physically there. Like, for example, if somebody's, you know, gone through surgery, it maybe isn't at that moment. It's when they're back home and you can be there to help around the house with cooking and mobility. So, like, you've got to just become very proactive and organized about prioritizing, communicating, so you know that you're on the same page with that person. And that's something that people do a lot, and it's natural when something shocks you and when you're going into that sort of meltdown phase, is to think, what if, and you're upset, and then it escalates into, not only am I upset for that family member, I'm now upset for the other family members that's going to affect. I'm thinking about in 6 months time, what if, and when that happens, you've got to bring it back, haven't you, really bring it back to the present and what you can actually physically or emotionally deal with, because it's real, not what might be down the road.
You know, there are two very important psychological concepts that are happening in that kind of a scenario. One of them happens to be the fact that those caregivers, the ones that are taking care of the person who's ill, are actually, and we have seen this in a lot of research, they become just as psychologically affected as the person who is sick, because they feel so helpless and they don't know what they can do. So they are in effect being affected psychologically. And on the other side, there's that grieving process as well. And when we look at the grieving process that Kubler-Ross has shown us, it's that shock, that denial, and then we move into anger and that bargaining. If I had done this, then this would have happened. If I was there, then she would have been, or she wouldn't have been. And then there's the sadness that kicks in before acceptance. But what people are grieving in that moment is what they thought would happen. The life that they thought they would have had with the person who's ill. The life that they thought would continue. And so they're also grieving that, not just grieving the illness and what it's doing to their loved one.
Mm. Some people are good at the conversation and the managing emotion of others. Some people are better at being practical. I can't deal with the emotion, but I can be, I'm a doer, or I can, you know, offer to help financially. It's coping strategies. People find their own way of coping. So I suppose when you might feel that you're being judged in some way by your behavior, it's about explaining, this is how I'm coping, or you being more sympathetic to others because that's how they're coping. Somebody's texting here to say, yeah, but some sick relatives understand, others are needy and selfish. That's a difficult one, isn't it? Whatever the view is, but if you're feeling the pressure to be there, what do you do, or how do you reconcile that within yourself?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think when this person is saying others are needy and selfish, sometimes you have to look at the personality of the individual as well. If that's who they were before, then that's different. But if they were never that way beforehand, the needy, what's coming off as needy and selfish, is actually fear, and it's a need to bring people closer because of the fear of dying or the fear of something bad happening to them or not being around their family. So it might come off as needy and selfish, but it's not necessarily needy and selfish.
It's a lot to consider. I do think it's a challenge for expatriates generally. There's always that sense of either missing out or should be there more, or dealing, we've talked about it on the health show before as well, about how you can manage it. And some people in the UAE have brought family members to be with them here, you know, across the board, across different nationalities, and that's great if you're able to do that. So there's lots of different things that happen in our lives that bring about change. One of the things we touched on earlier that we need to come back to is relationships. We're kind of talking about relationships in this setting, but this is about your partner. So when you notice they've changed, what do you do? So there might be many different reasons. So identifying that, whether it is the fact that you've been apart for some time and getting back together, it feels different. Why is it different? What's happened whilst I was away? Or have I changed? Or is it stress or something going on at work? So there's many reasons. So it's about identifying what's changed between us.
You know, one of the things I feel that sometimes I'm like a broken record about is the idea of communication in a couple. In a relationship, communication is key. And if you feel that there is a change in the relationship, this is where you want to bring that up. And I find it interesting that we are very comfortable to do that in every aspect of our life when we feel that there's something that's different, especially at work. If we feel like we're being treated differently, if we feel like we're not, we're experiencing a change or there's a change in a role, we ask questions, we evaluate, we look at it, we consider, we reflect on it, but we don't necessarily do that with things that are very close to us. So the number one thing when it comes to relationships and experiences of change is communication. If you feel like your partner is different, ask, talk to them, have a sit down, and actually even reflect, like, you asked the perfect question, Suzanne, am I changing? And thus it's making me look at my partner in a different way rather than my partner is the one who is changing. So it's about considering all variables, not just sort of assigning blame and pointing fingers.
Well, Donna Lancaster, a coach, talks about couples therapy and some of the things that come up when during couples therapy, and you do couples therapy, Thuraya. She says, I always start couples therapy by examining a client's relationship to themselves. She says so many people have unrealistic expectations of a partner that is based on their own unfinished business from childhood. Relationship therapy processes, the Imago relationship therapy proposes that essentially we attract partners with both the positive and negative qualities of our parents and react to their partners unconsciously through that filter. So if you enter a relationship as an emotional child looking to be rescued, warns Donna, it will never end well. Relationships only work when two healthy and fulfilled adults come together.
I won't say only work when that happens, but I will say that it's yes, it's easier when they're two healthy, stable individuals. Very rare to find anyways. But what I would say is it works when you're self-aware and you are open to discussing and open to evaluating not only your partner, but yourself as well. And I think the first thing that was said was extremely accurate in the sense that, you know, the first thing that we want to focus on in a relationship is the person's relationship to themselves, because it's very hard to truly understand what your couple looks like if you don't understand what you look like as an individual. And so in couples therapy, we look at not just the couple themselves as a group, but also as two individuals and who they are as individuals before they entered the relationship and after they entered the relationship. Because even if you'll hear a lot of people say, oh, I'd never let a relationship change me. Well, that's impossible. Relationships, every relationship in your life will change you in one way or another. Very small, very big, but they will provide changes. Some of those changes are good and some of those changes are negative. So it's about evaluating and being self-aware and being open to the possibility that maybe some of this is on you as well.
Yeah. Well, address, process and resolve conflict. Don't let yesterday's petty resentments become tomorrow's rage monsters. Make time to honestly share on what's bothering you and why without blame and harsh judgments. Can be easier said than done. What do you think? When we come back, we'll be taking a look at a counselling session, what might happen during a session of CBT, which is cognitive behavioural therapy. And this is about bringing about positive change when you go to therapy. So how the mechanics of it work and what you might expect if you're looking to do something like that. Yep, stay with us. Dr. Thoraya Kanafani, clinical psychologist based at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics in JLT. If you've just joined us or if you've just picked up the conversation, you will be able to listen to the podcast in full later today. In fact, pretty much within the hour of the show finishing, like with all the shows on Dubai Eye. Go to DubaiEye1038.com. You can click on the podcast link there. Yeah, that's what we're talking about, changes and how resilient you are to change, how much you embrace it or not, as the case may be. So share your thoughts on 4001 or via the Messenger app. And, you know, change comes in so many different ways in our lives. You know, the big stuff, the stuff we're not expecting, the things that we initiate and how it then plays out. And of course, with anything, I suppose when you're talking about resisting change, we talked about it a lot today about the fear factor. But ultimately, once you do make the steps towards change, you can't predict what's going to happen and you can't know if it's going to be a perfect outcome. But there's got to be a good reason why you're moving through some kind of change, I suppose, if you're the one initiating it. Now, for many people, and interestingly, we looked at it, was you sent it to me, Thoraya, and we picked out from this article about mental health issues in the UAE and why UAE companies must address mental health issues. Now, that's a story in itself. But what was in this article, this was in Gulf Business, is that a study in 2016 by the Dubai Health Authority, this study published, it showed that the majority of UAE employees were fearful of revealing mental health issues to their employers, lest they be marked as weak. It's an extremely common occurrence for patients to seek psychological services without informing their employers for fear of being ostracized or held back from promotions or even fired. And according to this article, 4-5% of the population in the UAE suffer from clinical depression. So if we're looking at what happens in the therapy room, and depending what the issue is, what the condition is that you have. But one thing that caught my attention, and if we're looking at trying to make positive changes and how therapy can help you with that, was this counselling connection page online. And there's a case study here using cognitive behavioural therapy. So this is what you do all the time in your profession, Dr. Thoraya. But for me, I know what it is and I've talked about it many times, but I hadn't really looked at the process. So here we go. I'm going to share this case study with you. Jocelyn works as a human resources manager for a large international organisation. She's becoming more and more stressed at work as the company is constantly changing and evolving. It's a requirement of her job that she keeps up with this change by implementing new strategies, as well as ensuring focus is kept on her main role of headhunting new employees. She finds that she's working 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, and doesn't have time for her friends and family. She started yelling at staff members when they ask her questions and when making small mistakes in their work. Concerned about her stress levels, Jocelyn decided to attend a counselling session, and this is an extract from Jocelyn's first session with her counsellor. counsellor says, "So Jocelyn, let's spend a few minutes talking about the connection between your thoughts and your emotions. Can you think of some times this week when you were frustrated with work?" Jocelyn says, "Yes, definitely. It was on Friday and I just implemented a new policy for staff members. I'd imagine that I would get a lot of phone calls about it because I always do, but I ended up snapping at people over the phone." Counsellor, "And how were you feeling at that time?" Jocelyn, "I felt quite stressed and also annoyed at other staff members because they didn't understand the policy." Counsellor, "And what was going through your mind?" Jocelyn, "I guess I was thinking that no one appreciates what I do." Counsellor, "Okay, you just identified what we call an automatic thought. Everyone has them. They're thoughts that immediately pop to mind without any effort on your part. Most of the time, the thought occurs so quickly you don't notice it, but it has an impact on your emotions. It's usually the emotion that you notice rather than the thought. Often these automatic thoughts are distorted in some way, but we usually don't stop to question the validity of the thought, but today that's what we're going to do." The counsellor proceeds to work through the cognitive behaviour process with Jocelyn as follows. So Thuraya, if we go through these processes and you tell me if this is kind of aligned with what you would do. So there's step one, identify the automatic thought. Together, the counsellor and Jocelyn identified Jocelyn's automatic thought as "no one appreciates what I do."
So for CBT in general, yes, this is definitely how this goes through. Now, I'm not necessarily a CBT therapist, so I'm more of an integrative therapist. So my theoretical orientation is more psychodynamic, which is more Freudian, as well as Gestalt, which is Gestalt therapy.
And what does that mean?
So these are very different. So for instance, with psychodynamic, Freudian psychodynamic, we look at things in the past and the way the child has, the adult has grown up. So you're looking at the childhood of the individual, how certain events have shaped them into who they are. We look at different defense mechanisms that they use. So things like, we know, like rationalization, repression, regression, those kinds of things. We also look at different areas of the personality, which we call the id, the ego, and the superego. And I feel like I'm getting too technical now, but it's sort of like the different sides of who we are. So things like what we call the id is that childish part of our personality, where it's I want it and I want it now, give it to me right now and I want to have it. And then the other side of our personality, which is what we call the superego, which is that very sociocultural aware side of our personality, where you can't have this, it's not appropriate, it's not culturally sound, you know, you shouldn't, those kinds of thoughts. And then the part of the personality where we call the ego, and that's in the middle, where it's trying to, the ego tries to balance out the impulsive side or the very like self-conscious side as well. So you can have it, but maybe not now. So in those kind of things. So that's the Freudian psychodynamic. And then Gestalt's a little bit different. But to get back to CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy really looks at the way the cognition, so the thought process that you have. So identifying the automatic thought in this scenario is very important. Nobody appreciates me. No one likes me. No one will care for me. Those kinds of thoughts are very automatic for people. And it instills and it creates an emotion that comes with that. So what ends up happening is that we focus on the I'm angry. But why are you angry? What did you think of that made you angry? What was the thought that you had? So in this situation, she got angry and she reacted because she felt that nobody appreciates her.
So step two is question the validity of the automatic thought. To question the validity of Jocelyn's automatic thought, the counsellor engages in the following dialogue. Counsellor, tell me, Jocelyn, what is the effect of believing that no one appreciates you? Jocelyn, well, it infuriates me. I feel so undervalued and it puts me in such a foul mood. Counsellor, okay, now I'd just like you to think for a moment, what could be the effect if you change that way of thinking? Jocelyn, you mean if I didn't think that no one appreciates me? Counsellor, yes. Jocelyn, I guess I'd be a lot happier in my job. Haha, I'd probably be nicer to be around. I'd be less snappy, more patient.
So what the counsellor is doing there is showing her the benefit of changing that automatic thought and of looking at things from a different perspective. And that would be the second step in that process.
And step three, challenge core beliefs. So to challenge Jocelyn's core belief, the counsellor engages in the following dialogue. Counsellor, Jocelyn, I'd like you to read through the list of common false beliefs and tell me if you relate to any of them. She hands over the list of common false beliefs. Jocelyn reads the list. Ah, yes, I can see how I relate to number four, that it's necessary to be competent and successful in all these things which are attempted. That's so true for me. The counsellor says, the reason these are called false beliefs is because they are extreme ways of perceiving the world. They are black or white and ignore the shades of grey in between.
Right. And so what that does, what that step does is introduce what we call negative self-talk. And negative self-talk in cognitive behavioral therapy highlights the different ways we talk to ourselves that are very negative and that affect us in negative ways. And that comes from essentially one of the most important things about CBT is the core belief of ourselves. And so the core belief usually is said in an I statement. So I'm not worthy, I'm not competent, I'm not good enough, I don't deserve this. And so in this case with Jocelyn. Sorry, I'm very bad with names. With Jocelyn, it's no one appreciate me is the automatic thought. But why would she think that nobody appreciates her? Sometimes the core belief there is I'm not good enough or I'm not competent enough. And that's the fear. So we have to tackle that core belief and change it. To do so, we need evidence otherwise. So all of these things, as you can see with cognitive behavioral therapy, focus a lot on the thoughts that a person has, either consciously or subconsciously, and they hope to adjust it and change it to a different perspective. So then it leads to different behavioral changes as well.
So to bring about those behavioral changes, to bring about positive change, I mean, how effective is CBT and how many sessions do you need? I mean, obviously depending, but roughly speaking.
So usually CBT will look at sessions between 12 and 15 sessions. Now, more often than not, a lot of research shows that CBT is only very effective for short-term solutions. So it works for a good 6 months to a year, but eventually things will come back, which is why most psychologists nowadays are moving towards integrative psychology instead of just picking one theoretical orientation. So for instance, when I was telling you before, I'm an integrative psychologist. What I do is I have my basis where I can look at my clients from a specific conceptualization, but I draw upon different therapeutic techniques. So I do use a lot of CBT techniques because they're very helpful, but it is not my focus because of the fact that a lot of research shows that using integrative approaches for clients tends to lead to long-term therapeutic progress rather than using only one therapeutic orientation.
Explaining change in all its glory, really, and different circumstances and different techniques and ways to move through change in a positive way. When we come back, we'll be addressing this message from somebody that's messaged us here saying, I'm a very financially responsible person and being financially safe is very important to me. Recently, I found out my spouse had created a massive amount of debt, and while I'm normally able to adjust to change in a snap, this time I'm having bouts of unexplained crying, feeling betrayed. I've never had a problem with change, but I'm having a huge issue adjusting to debt. I can't stand debt. So let's just address this message. This person's message in, I'm a very responsible, financially responsible person, and being financially safe is very important to me. I recently found out my spouse had created a massive amount of debt, and while I'm normally I'm able to adjust to change in a snap, this time I'm having bouts of unexplained crying, feeling betrayed, etc. I have never had a problem with change, but I'm having a huge issue adjusting to debt. I can't stand debt.
You know, it's interesting that this individual is saying that they don't have a problem with change, but this is actually one of the biggest changes this person might experience, because you're changing the way you look at your spouse, you're changing the way you look at your life now because of the financial, you know, instability that you might be feeling. You're changing the way you have to see your future moving forward. Maybe you had plans because you were a financially responsible person, you were financially safe. Now your plans need to change because obviously you need to help pay off some debts, maybe or maybe not. So all of these things are changes, and there's going to be changes in the way that you feel. You said you're feeling betrayed. Feeling betrayed in this kind of situation is a very big change in the stability of the relationship itself, because before you were feeling stable, feeling comfortable. Now all of a sudden you got that curveball And now everything is all shook up.
Yeah. And the, if, you know, if we all have our values, how attuned you are to what your values are. But for this person, she's very aware, or he's very aware, that a big core value for this person is being financially responsible and being financially safe. And when that gets rocked, and it's rocking within a marriage where your core values are not aligned, there's potential for huge issues there.
Of course, especially since, you know, this is a recent revelation. So this is something that the spouse seemed to have kept from this person, which means that on some level there is that feeling of betrayal, of being lied to, of being deceived, which is not good for a relationship in essence anyways.
So what does this person do?
Well, in this sense, I would definitely like have a sit down with your spouse, talk through what is the debt, find out exactly, see what you can and can't do. If this is something that you're not willing to help your spouse with, because this is something that you feel that they should have taken care of, then maybe assist them in finding a proper plan, creating a sheet, maybe even visiting a financial advisor, those kinds of things. Definitely maybe discussing why was this not brought up before.
And why has this happened, really?
Right. Yeah. And where is the money being spent? Those kinds of things. Because maybe when you speak to your spouse, you may actually understand where the money is going. It could be going to family members to help people out. It could be to, you know, provide for you, even though they don't have a pretty good salary. They wanted to keep your life comfortable. So there are so many things before assuming and jumping in and getting very angry. Discussing this and finding out more is very important as well.
And understanding what the truth of the situation is. Why has this come about? As in, is it linked to an underlying issue or reason from your partner? And I guess as well, the truth, in the sense that, is this the amount? Is there anything else that I'm going to be surprised with? So let's, you know, allowing them to feel that they can really be honest, so you know what you're dealing with, is a huge thing, isn't it? Well, I mean, as fearful and scary as it might be, but if it's happening, it's better to know absolutely what it is, the truth of the matter. What is it that you're really dealing with, so you can get on and rectify the situation? And that might take time, but it's better to know completely what you're dealing with rather than get more surprises along the way.
Of course, because you don't want things to trickle in rather than just all cards on the table and now this is what's going on.
And although this isn't necessarily a good situation, of course, but you're not alone. It's actually something that happens quite a lot. And that's not to say it's okay that it happens. It's actually very interesting that this can happen. You think that two people that live together, that are married, you're going to know what's happening with each other. But that's not the case, is it? You see it all the time in clinic.
Yes, absolutely. I see a lot of clients, that couples that actually don't know anything about each other's finances, which in essence is a little bit worrisome, because, you know, when you're a couple, you don't have to share your finances, but sharing information is important, because you need to know where you're at, because whatever the spouse is going through, you will also be experiencing as well, because it'll be part of the family. And so not knowing anything puts you in the dark and can cause potential problems moving forward.
So if we're looking at personal plans, maybe you're looking, we were listening earlier to somebody talking about wanting to go to university. On that note, they're asking about positive psychology university courses in Dubai. We don't think there is, per se, an actual degree course. There are different elements within or existing degree courses, but not positive psychology courses. But maybe check out online if that's something you want to pursue. What else are you looking to change in your life? Maybe you're looking to the future. Now, the Harvard Business School has a plan, a personal plan. Dr. Thuraya.
So when Harvard sort of looked at creating healthier life and creating a healthier life for people, they set these seven ways to jumpstart this healthy change in your life. One of them, and the first one, is setting a goal. Now, when you set a goal, you always have to be careful to not set unrealistic goals, right? So you want to think of what we call a SMART goal. And a lot of people that work in business fields know the SMART goals. And that's, SMART is the acronym for specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and time-based. So those five things must define your goal, because it has to be something that you can actually realistically achieve. Once you've passed setting your goal, you have to ask yourself sort of the big question: what is it that I want to do with this goal? Why is this goal important to me? And then moving on into picking your choice for change. What part of myself and my life do I have to change in order to get to my goal? Because a big part of this is changing a good what you're comfortable with and getting yourself a little bit out of your comfort zone, committing yourself, finding any kind of obstacles that could come in your way, figuring out what you can do to avoid those obstacles, and then finally giving yourself a reward after you've achieved what you set out to do. And a big part of that, when we're looking at it completely as a health plan, you know, this is the Harvard health plan or healthy change plan, but when you look at it in your own life without, you know, making it sound too complicated, it's about realistically evaluating what you can and can't do with what you do on a daily basis. Because we know that sometimes work can get in the way. We know life can get in the way. Kids, the routine, all of these things. So you don't want to set yourself up to want something so difficult that you won't be able to achieve it, and you start to think of yourself as less competent and less confident in these kind of abilities. It's about setting small goals and achieving small baby steps. And every time you achieve those baby steps, you start to feel better and better about yourself. And so that is the healthier way to make a plan, rather than sort of making a goal and say, okay, I'm going to get there. So it has to be very specific and it has to be very realistic.
That word realistic it's been a word I've read over the last couple of days researching for this show. It comes up a lot. It's about being realistic in your expectations of your relationships, of your working life, of your social life, of your leisure time. But being aware and having realistic expectations on yourself. And all of the anxiety and stresses and depressions often stem from this unrealistic expectation that we place on ourselves as individuals. And it's about trying to harness and manage that effectively.
And of others as well. And I think a big part of that, when you say realistic, I get a lot of clients that say to me, you know, I'm not negative. I don't look at life negatively. I look at it realistically. And I say, no, you're not. You're looking at it negatively, because reality is based on both negative and positive. And I think one of the most beautiful symbols to signify that is the yin and yang sign, where you see it and it's just, it shows you that you can't have the full circle without both parts being there. And even within both parts, there's the other opposite parts within that. So it's about understanding that both positive and negative occurs in life. And you can't, being realistic doesn't mean only focusing on the negative. You have to see the whole circle and recognize that in everything there's going to be something else there as well. And so when you're looking at others and you're looking at yourself, looking at your positives and your negatives, and looking at others' positives and negatives, because we're very quick to look at our negatives and other people's positives and we don't tend to do the opposite. So looking at it as a full circle.
Well, it's a full circle as we've come to the end of the show today. Just to quickly mention Vivek, who's texted in, and so there's going to be some exciting changes for you coming up, Vivek, because you've got a new baby coming into the family. Your baby is expected in 10 days' time. So whether it's your first baby or not, I don't know. But again, ringing in the changes, preparing, planning, communicating, being realistic, trying to allow for yourself, your partner, to get that sleep as and when needed, lots of good healthy foods. You're bringing a baby into the world at a lovely time of year here in the UAE, because it's getting cooler. So once baby's settled, you'll be able to go out into the fresh air of the UAE over the coming months. But one thing I don't think we can help Vivek with today, but thank you for putting it in our court, but it's an honour, in fact, Vivek, asking us to suggest baby names for your baby coming into the world in 10 days' time. Boys' names, in fact. I know many lovely boys' names, but I think that's something for you and your partner to really choose and decide on. But thank you very much for asking us nevertheless. And yeah, and we wish you all the very, very best with your new arrival. So Dr. Thoraya, thank you very much. To find out more about Dr. Thoraya, to connect with her directly, she's at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics in JLT. All the details are up on our website today as well, and you can connect with her and us through social media, Facebook, Twitter and the like. So until next time, Dr. Thoraya, thank you.
Thanks, Suzanne.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcast at DubaiEye1038.com.